Missing in-person interaction at industry events? Fear not. ATS London 2021 will be held in person on November the 3rd and 4th at the Velodrome in Olympic Park, Stratford. We're going to be discussing the future of the advertising and marketing industry, and we've got an awesome lineup of speakers joining us at this incredible venue. Visit events.exchangewide.com/ATS London 2021 to find out more and to book your tickets today.
The MarTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the MarTech Podcast. I'm Grace Dillon, editor at ExchangeWire, and joining me this week are Camilla Child, director of commercial strategy at The Telegraph and one of our esteemed Wires Global 2021 judges. Hello, Camilla.
Hi, Grace. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Good, excellent. Nice to have you on. And ExchangeWire's Director of Global Partnerships and legendary AMS, Anne-Marie Sheedy. Hello, Anne-Marie.
Legendary. Good morning, Grace. Good morning, Camilla.
What an intro.
Exactly.
Wonderful to have you both with us. So as regular listeners will know by now, the podcast will begin with a discussion of three news stories, followed by a more detailed discussion with Camilla about what she's currently working on. So without further ado, let's get into the first story. So FTC Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter has indicated that the US regulator may increasingly order tech companies who violate privacy laws to delete their algorithms. This form of remediation would be issued on the basis that offenders' algorithms were built on or refined by the illicit collection of user data. The penalty has been issued before, once in 2019 against Cambridge Analytica, who were accused of misrepresenting how they would use information collected from Facebook users, and again this year against photo app owner EverAlbum, who allegedly deceived their users by using facial recognition technology without consent. Slaughter considers the technique an important step in addressing the motives behind companies' decisions to violate privacy regulation and, quote, not just the surface level practice that's problematic. According to Digiday, lawyers representing tech firms have been increasingly advising their clients to take heed of Slaughter's comments, with one firm quoted as saying that algorithmic disgorgement is here to stay in the FTC's arsenal of enforcement mechanisms. So, do you think this mechanism is fair, and do you think it could be an effective way of clamping down on the improper use of data or data law and privacy violations? Camilla, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one because we're starting to see regulators looking not just at how data is being collected and the validity of that, but then also the gains that have been made from that data as well. So I think, you know, in principle, it's fair that those regulations, those privacy regulations, should apply not just to the data itself, but then how that data is applied, how it's used. I mean, we talk about data as such a broad topic, and it is, but really data is just information. It's just kind of stuff, and what's actually monetizable off the back of that is what you can do with that information. So I think from that point of view and in principle, I think it is fair.
Yeah, interesting. Anne-Marie, what do you think?
I agree with Camilla. I think it's interesting the way you describe it as information. It is information, and it is about what you do. Violation of privacy laws, I mean, it's a huge issue on many levels, and I'm really interested as to how they will clamp down on it, because there are gains made from data. We've talked for years about big data. Now I think it's more about little data, if you know what I mean. It's the power of one and what they hold on individuals and what they do with that. With regards to Cambridge Analytica, yeah, I think it was good that that was uncovered. With regards to kind of the consent of users, I think there's still a huge educational piece there, because there's various things that go around and, you know, share your picture or do something, or do you like this quiz, you do whatever. People don't actually know what they're opting into. And that's where the problem is. There's a huge educational piece. And I don't know if it's necessarily fair that it's going to be directed at particular tech firms or the agencies or the brands. I think governments in general have a huge responsibility to help educate people. I think we're in a bit of a bubble and we're quite knowledgeable and we know what's going on. I still just go, fine, I want access to that, here, have my data. I don't click in and read through all the terms and conditions. And I think there's an educational piece there that needs to be improved on before they just start whacking fines on people.
I get that. But do you think that having this sort of mechanism in place can help? I mean, and this is a topic that will come up later in another story, but do you think it will help foster user trust? So, you know, whilst there is a lack of education, there is also, as a result of that, a sort of mistrust of how companies use, our data. Do you think that it's still a necessary step to clamp down in this way and tell, you know, companies to essentially scrap their AI and their algorithms, that will help, you know, users actually trust companies more, knowing or trust giving their data away more than they do now?
It's a tough one because there's a lack of information. So people have been, there's been a value exchange without people realizing it. And the Joe Blogs doesn't kind of really understand how they can access information, how they can surf the web, how they can look at news sites, etc., and get information. They had no idea what was going on. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, click this, accept our terms. And they're like, what? So I don't think it's fair. No, I think there's a huge, huge amount of work that needs to be done. And I don't know where it starts or who should take responsibility, because ultimately people are, you know, trying to give users an experience. And it's where that experience comes from and what they're doing and how they kind of go about creating an environment where they understand what data is being shared.
Camilla, what do you think of that? Do you think that it's a valid point that, you know, it's probably too harsh for regulators to sort of come down with an iron fist and order firms to scrap their algorithms when, you know, perhaps they could be doing more to help educate consumers so they can make a more informed choice?
I think, as Anne-Marie was saying, I think the how is really important. So whether this is, you know, addressed on a case-by-case basis or whether this is kind of a broad brushstrokes approach that's going to be taken, that to me at least isn't quite clear yet how they will be implementing that and whether it will, as you said, Anne-Marie, be alongside an education piece. I think both is important. And I suppose kind of one of the key messages here is that we're on this journey, that there is momentum towards better understanding among the general public of how the data is being used, but also better transparency and accountability. And I think they both probably need to be worked on in tandem.
Could you imagine if they turned off, you know, Google or Amazon or Facebook or Apple, whatever it is, what the general public would do? What would they turn to? Would they understand? Do they have the option to go, oh, okay, actually, I'm not going to go on Google. I'm going to go on Firefox, because they've got a much more responsible approach to how they track what I'm doing. I just think there's a huge disconnect.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's so much more to talk about in the general public. And I think one of the things that it's quite healthy for us to do is to think of ourselves, even though we do work in the industry, as consumers as well. There are many, many more consumers in the world than there are people who are working in ad tech, and to take that kind of check and that step back, as you're saying, say, okay, well, how would the average person feel about this? Or what would they do? Or what would the ramifications be? That's, I think, a very healthy thing to do. I think GDPR in general, and just having those cookie banners that we see everywhere now in place, has done a certain amount to bring this to public attention, because it's kind of exposing those words and that fact, just everyday actions of being online. But yes, I think there's plenty more to do. And in terms of the detail as to how different businesses are working and different companies are using data and how data is being processed, there's so much more there to shine a light on, I think, for the public. So I think, you know, we've come some way in doing that. Just with having cookie banners there, I think is a big step. But yeah, there's definitely more knowledge to be shared, I think.
I don't want to go off piece, and I probably want to move on to the next story, Grace, but there's an interesting one. So we've got global listeners, but in the UK at the moment, there's the NHS has had a brief period whereby you could opt out to share your information. I personally haven't done it. I missed that time frame. Apparently, it might be open till September, but you have to.
I think
to
it was extended, yeah.
Yeah, it's been extended. Why? Because nobody knew about it. There was no campaigns to say, oh, by the way, everybody in the National Health Services, where, you know, we've got all your information, medical information, we're going to use that for what good or what, I don't know. But there's no general knowledge about, yeah, just if you're not happy with it, if you're not happy with us using your records and your information, it might be anonymized. But I don't know about that. And that to me is the same way as about the majority of people do not know what tech companies are doing and how they're managing their information, their data, and where it's going. And I just think it's sinful. You know, it's just, this is a government-led organization that hasn't spent any money on actually informing the UK population about what it's doing with their medical records. And that's data or information, as you put it, Camilla, but that's very sensitive information. So if that's currently going on, what? How in God's name are we going to manage data from what I'm doing shopping-wise or where I'm moving around because my phone constantly has Bluetooth on so the COVID app can track me and ping me if I've been in an area where someone's reported that, you know, they've tested positive. Sorry, that's kind of off-piste, but it's still the data and information and sharing and education piece that I feel is just hugely overlooked.
I know. I mean, it goes to show how big and how extensive an issue it is. You know, it's not, it's never just one story really at the end of the day about the FTC, you know, implementing one order. It goes far beyond that. And it's just such a shame that we, you know, have it limited to 10 minutes per story, but I am going to move us on to the second one. So, this is from an article in AdExchanger written by James Hercher, and it concerns Hide My Email, which is one of the new features announced by Apple at their Worldwide Developers Conference last month, and could prove catastrophic for newsletter providers and publishers. So the feature allows iOS users to generate fake or burner email addresses, which forward messages to their real inbox, allowing users to avoid having to provide their real email addresses when registering to websites. Whilst the feature is currently only available to a small portion of Apple users, those with the latest iOS who are logged into iCloud and who use the native Mail app for email, the feature could be damaging if adopted at scale. On top of anonymizing users, Hide My Email will remove the tracking pixel that enables senders to see who has opened their email, an integral metric for email-based ad sellers and newsletter providers who often sell sponsorships based on open rates. The feature will also prove disruptive to publishers' first-party data collection efforts and could leave them open to exploitation, such as by a user using several different email addresses to sign up for free trials or to avoid paying for a subscription. There's currently no official process through which publishers can air their grievances directly to Apple. So, why do you think that Apple have introduced Hide My Email? Is it in the name of privacy, something that they often, you know, promote as being integral to their business ethos? Or is this another instance where we could accuse them of being anti-competitive? So we've seen in the past instances where they have been accused of attempting to block or disadvantage competitors and, you know, are currently facing antitrust cases in the EU and the US. So could they be accused of attempting to monopolize email-based advertising? What do you think, Anne-Marie? I'll come to you first.
Oh, well, the cynic in me, because no, it's nothing to do with privacy. It's their walled garden. They're totally in it for the money. It's just another way for them to kind of charge premiums. And I kind of wonder, what are they trying to do? You can't bite the hand that feeds you in a way, but that I feel is what they're doing. And publishers are trying to make an honest living. If their content is good and people want their newsletters and they subscribe to it, I think it's very unfair that they're going to put a barrier in the way, because it's a bit like they're also something in development is like Apple Pay Later. So they're integrating this service with Goldman Sachs, who's the bank behind Apple Cards, and that's going to be a partner. And it's just, they're just creating this environment where they have complete control. I don't think they're putting the customer first. I think Apple globally, if you look at it, you know, I think they've got the more wealthier individual with more disposable income. So do I care? Is it a burner email? Is it for my benefit? Are they protecting me? I don't think so. I'm a high net worth individual. The more information that they have, the more they can control me, the more that they can see what I'm doing and protect the information that I'm getting means that they can actually put a higher price point on me.
Strong words, but you know,
I'm an Android user.
Likewise. Camilla, what do you think? Do you think that, you know, there is actually a genuine privacy element to this feature, or do you think that, you know, there is a kind of underhand element to it as well?
I think the messaging is clearly all about privacy and being privacy first. I think we've seen that from measures that they've brought out, but also even from their marketing campaigns that very much put privacy across, you know, all of their imaging. We've all seen the little Apple logo that becomes a padlock. It's a very, you know, subtle symbolism, but I think we can all see what they're doing there. But so the messaging is very much privacy first. I think we'll probably have to see how this plays out. I don't think this story is probably finished running yet, and we'll have to see what happens next, and what the implications are going to be. I think, as Anne-Marie was kind of alluding to, from a publisher point of view, we have a direct relationship with our readers, with the people who are coming to our site, who are, you know, picking up our papers, who are reading our content, and who are signing up for our newsletters. That's a direct relationship that we have, where an individual has requested to receive a newsletter from us. So, you know, I think there's a question as to why any platform or any environment should be an arbiter of whether that direct relationship should exist or not, or whether it should be disrupted. When, you know, if there's been consent given to have that newsletter or whatever it might be, this would affect, you know, any brand that has email address based interactions with an individual. I think the question is, why should a platform be the arbiter of that direct relationship that we have with our readers?
Camilla, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm kind of doing it. But have they actually directly approached yourselves and kind of explained to you the rationale behind their decision making?
I can't really comment on that, unfortunately.
Yeah. No, it's fair enough. I had to ask, but I can understand. it's a difficult situation, but I'm curious to know what the behind the scenes approach is. You know, how they can justify what they're doing when you've got a commercial organization and there's a value exchange, great content, great experience. And like you said, that you want that one-to-one or one-to-many relationship where you understand what your readers are interested in wanting. And they're trying to take control over that. I just think it's, you know, we talk about the year of the publishers, but you know, it's the publishers are striking back. And now it's like, hang on, you're just kind of ripping the rug from underneath us again.
Yeah, I think it sort of speaks to the value exchange that needs to exist in order for the internet to function as it continues to function. You know, we have an open and free internet where people can go online and find all kinds of content, but that doesn't come for free, if you see what I mean. You know, yeah. The quality journalism that we're producing, it's all written by professionals. It's, you know, it comes out of an amazing newsroom. It's all fact-checked, it's regulated. All of those things have a cost associated. So there needs to be a value exchange, a fair and open value exchange between us and our readers. And advertising, whether that's within a newsletter environment or, you know, wherever that might be, is part of that. And it helps to fund, you know, really good, high quality content as well. So that value exchange needs to exist. Mm. So, you know, anything that kind of threatens that is, I think, a real question mark. And one of our sort of fundamental tenets at The Telegraph is being reader first and putting the reader first in everything that we do, whether that's in terms of the on-site experience, the journalism that we're creating. Absolutely everything is about putting the person who's reading our editorial first and foremost. And that relationship is super important to us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where can publishers sort of go from here? So as mentioned in the article, there's no official mechanism, at least I'm assuming in the US, where, you know, AdExchanger is based, where publishers can, you know, lobby Apple Do you think this is just going to inevitably lead to more legal action? What do you think, you know, publishers can, newsletter providers can do to, you know, protest against this and try and avoid it actually?
I think, you know, as I said earlier on, I think there's much more to play out on this. And this you know, mechanism hasn't been rolled out across the entirety of the Apple ecosystem yet, and may not be. Who knows how this is going to play out. But, you know, as publishers, we have lots of conversations amongst ourselves. And I can't possibly comment on what regulators might do or how that might work. But yeah, obviously having those open conversations about what's going on is really important, both amongst news brands or publishers more broadly, and just kind of raising awareness as to what is going on, whether that's right, and whether that's, you know, as I said, disrupting that fair value exchange of what we're doing as part of our businesses.
I wonder if they, you know, with this kind of this Apple Pay that they're developing, where it'll allow people to buy products and pay for them in monthly installments, whether or not they'll kind of wrap up a subscription model in that, or, you know, look at the kind of the similarities that it has in terms of the Apple Card monthly installments program, where owners can, you know, buy iPhones and other Apple devices at 0% financing. And if they 0% if they pay them off in is 24 months or something, will they start creating this kind of membership or club environment, going, oh, well, you're on here, and then you get access to the Telegraph, rather than paying X amount for a monthly subscription to access this quality journalism, you get all open access. And will there be a value exchange where they'll give you more information then, if, you know, if it, let's just say the Telegraph decide to opt into this or experiment with it, will there be another value exchange whereby they'll give you visibility and insight into the analytics behind the user based on their credit, what they do, what they've bought, where their interest is? Will there, you know, will that could be a way it might play out? I don't know.
We're going deep into hypotheticals now, Anne-Marie. Yes. We're very much in the philosophy of the internet, I think. But yeah, I mean, I couldn't possibly claim to read the minds of Apple or any platform and say what they might do next or what they might be thinking of, other than, you know, it's a platform, it's an environment, and publishers or news brands, we're the ones generating the journalism, the content that is being shared and is being read within those environments. So without that content, there's not much for them to share or for people to look at within those environments. So I think for me, it's just really important to keep coming back to that relationship that we have with our readers, and that direct relationship, or as we definitely see it, a direct relationship that we have with the individuals reading our content, engaging with our content, you know, commenting on articles. These are, you know, real people, real individuals. And I think that's really important to remember, particularly when it comes to conversations like this that kind of broaden out to how, yeah, exactly the how, the platforms that people are using to engage with our site or with our newsletters.
Yeah. That's very true.
Well, as you said, Camilla, I certainly don't think it's the case that this is anywhere close to being over, and I'm sure there'll be a lot more coming out, you know, over the next few weeks and months regarding the story, and, you know, how publishers and, well, everyone else will respond to hide my email and what will happen going forward. But I'll move us along to our last story of the week, which is that IPG's Arun Kumar says that it's up to brands to dispel misconceptions surrounding data sharing and to inform consumers of its benefits. Writing in Adweek, Kumar argues that consumer distrust towards data sharing comes partly as a result of them not understanding how their data is used, especially to their benefit. And he cites two research studies, one from Pew, which finds that 81% of Americans think there are more risks than benefits to sharing their data, and another study which found that 78% of global consumers think data sharing advantages businesses more than consumers. This lack of understanding poses a very real threat to the ad-supported model that keeps much of the internet freely accessible, as well as to brands' often hard-won relationships with their customers. If brands want to continue to benefit from online advertising, then they need to convey to consumers that, as he calls them, accountable market participants handle data in a highly secure manner, and that advertising that that's informed by data provided by consumers provides a better customer experience. Brands are best positioned to tackle this issue as they often receive greater trust from consumers. It's also important that marketers take on this responsibility so that it no longer sits in the hands of tech giants who have long dominated popular narratives around data sharing and been partly responsible for consumers' perception of it, according to Kumar. So do you agree with Kumar that it's up to brands really to make consumers aware of how data sharing benefits them? And are you surprised that, you know, a seemingly significant portion of the public either aren't aware or aren't really convinced that giving their data to companies, you know, gives them any benefit? Camilla, I'll come to you first then.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of circles back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of trust and public awareness. I think any business that's collecting or processing or controlling anyone's data should obviously be clear and transparent on what they're doing. That's, you know, one of the fundamental tenets of GDPR and everything that's been going on around privacy lately. But exactly as we were kind of getting to before, I think it's also really important to make clear why that is happening, like what that value exchange is with that individual, you know, in terms of this is the data that we're taking, but this is what you're getting off the back of that, whether that's access to free content or just access to the open internet, functionalities like, you know, remembering what's in your basket or any kind of personalization that you might see on site that actually improves your experience. That's really important to explain so that people, I think, know what's going on. And again, as I kind of mentioned before, I think just with having cookie banners there, that's brought these topics to the public's attention much more than they ever were before. It seems less of a siloed topic that you would only really know about if you worked in the industry now. But the full ramifications of how that data is being used and why it's important, why it's actually good for the consumer and how it benefits them. I think that does still, that hasn't been brought to the fore in the same way. So I think there's more to do there.
Anne-Marie, what do you think?
It's a tough one. And like Camilla said, we touched upon it earlier on. It is about the value exchange, the benefit, the trusts, being clear and transparent. But then I kind of question, what about when it's transactional? So if we take the life that we're living at the moment, where we're fortunate enough to be kind of back in a world that's more familiar to us, where we've got access, we can go out, we can go to restaurants, we can go to pubs and go to shops and stuff. But within that, there's still this element of you need to check in. What's happening with that data that I'm checking in? Yes. It's to track and make sure that I'm, you know, not surrounded by someone that might test positive for COVID. But also there's the element of how many apps have you got on your phone now where you've got to download in order to be able to order some food or order a drink, and the data that I'm exchanging there, that is that the responsibility of the pub or the restaurant or the brand behind that? Are they clearly explaining to me what they're going to do with that information? Probably. Am I looking at it there and then? Absolutely not. I would just like to order my food or order a drink. So I'm giving them my phone number. I'm giving them my email address. I'm giving them, in some cases, my date of birth. And that's a lot of information. I have no idea where that's going, but that, you know, what will build out from that is hopefully that those brands behind that will act responsibly and give me the option where I don't need, if I can go to the bar or I've got somebody coming and taking my order and they'll kind of explain going, oh, you can delete this now, or we can turn this off, or they can explain that if you would like more information from us, or if you'd like information about things that we feel that you'd be interested in and they do it responsibly, then I'll be okay with it. But if they start hounding me and sending me a load of crap that I'm not interested and just spamming me, I won't be very happy. Well, what can I do with it? So how do you kind of get that balance of the transaction elements, the personalization, but also understand that, you know, Camilla, going back to that experience that you offer your readers, so your subscribers, your clientele, you give us some information, we'll deal with it responsibly. We'll let you know what we're doing with it. And we're doing it because it's the information that you've given us. We're looking at what articles you're reading, what information you're interested, and we'll try and give you more of what you want. I just don't know how at scale brands are realistically going to be able to do that.
do you think it's something that, you know, could require more regulation? Because you might argue that Kumar sort of assumes, I'm sure he doesn't, obviously, but that, you know, brands are sort of just this one homogenous group of very responsible actors, whereas, you know, brands will have different ways of going about, you know, attempting to inform their customers about how they're using their data. Do you think it will require standardization? Do you think that it's, you know, whilst there is a brand responsibility, it goes sort of beyond that to something bigger?
That's a really good question. And what comes to mind for me is the financial services industry. And personally, I bank with First Direct and their communication, what they do with my data and how they manage it, I value, because I can get a call at 8 o'clock in the morning when they've seen someone try to access my account. I'm going to go, oh, Anne-Marie, are you in Azerbaijan right now? I'm like, no, I'm not. Okay, thank you. And they're managing and tracking my information securely and safely. And I think there's a lot to be learned from the financial services industry. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying they're all perfect, but the accountability that they have, I think there are lessons to be learned there in terms of what they do and how they manage it and how secure they are and the understanding of how they communicate with their customers. I think there's something in that.
What about you, Camilla? Do you think it will be a case of, you know, stronger enforcement, or do you think that there's probably enough regulation and it just needs to be implemented better, or what do you think?
It's difficult. I think maybe it's a question of where is regulation versus where is best practice. And I think even since GDPR came out, which now feels like such a long time ago but wasn't, since then, you know, there was so much confusion at the start as to what is a brand's responsibility as to, you know, what they put on their website, what's in their T's and C's, what's in their privacy policy. There was a lot of confusion amongst brands, but also amongst the general public as to what's going on and what does this mean. But within that, I think we've sort of got to a pattern where there's a sort of an accepted model of, okay, there has to be a cookie banner. You know, you can find out more, you can go into a, you know, a consent management system, you know, whatever you want to do. There's some best practices there. Impossible to comment on, you know, what regulations might come out in future as a result of this. I think, Anne-Marie, your example, or your previous example about as society opens up a bit more and we get a little bit more back to normal, but perhaps not quite the same as before, illustrates that the world is changing so fast at the moment that we kind of need to keep on moving to keep up with those changing circumstances. And I think that applies to data collection and usage, how it's applied online, as well as, you know, in your financial services example.
Yeah, I think, and part of me is kind of going, let's put it to one side. We're individuals at the end of the day, and there's a freedom of choice. We choose to use technology. We choose to opt in. There has to be, you know, there's got to be some give and take. These companies run, they pay someone's wages, they're doing something. It's an ecosystem that needs feeding, and, you know, with good comes bad, but that's because of bad practice and bad behavior and what we accept. And I just kind of think that we need to humanize it a bit more.
Do you think it's, you know, somewhat to that point, do you think it's inevitable that there will always be a portion of the public who still won't necessarily trust brands' use? You know, if you think of, as you've mentioned, Camilla, you know, increased use of cookie banners and pop-ups, there are still people who don't read them and, you know, go ahead and, you know, accept anyway. So is it, you know, do we have to accept that there'll always be a segment of society who just won't trust what brands are doing but won't necessarily buy into reading into what they're doing, or won't necessarily look into how their data is being used? And how can we deal with that, if at all?
Potentially, I think, you know, there needs to be a bit of mutual responsibility, probably, in that you have to, a brand or, you know, any business needs to make that information available, accessible, comprehensible to anybody, but also you are relying on the individual engaging with that as well, and taking the time to understand it and to you know, see what's there. It kind of comes back to that education piece that Anne-Marie mentioned before about making these things just more widely known and more widely understood. I think trust is sort of changing a bit, and we've seen a decline in trust over the years as to people becoming, you know, more suspicious perhaps about what's going on online and how their data is being used, with various different negative stories. But then there's also evidence of trust increasing in certain environments. The Edelman Trust Barometer for 2021 indicated that there was an increased awareness and increased trust among consumers with regards to media literacy or trusting quality journalism that they see online, and really reaching out for that and leaning on that, especially with such a fast changing news agenda that we've seen recently. So yeah, there is change there. But yes, I think there has to be kind of a bit of a two-way street, in that you have to make all of that information available and you have to be clear and comprehensible. But equally, individuals need to take responsibility. And I think that largely they probably will.
Hopefully. I'm sure everyone's hoping so. But we'll leave it there and move on to the second part of the podcast, where we talk to you in more detail, Camilla, about what you're working on at The Telegraph. So you mentioned a new product called Telegraph One. Would you like to tell us more about that?
Yeah, of course. So Telegraph One is something that we brought out last year, actually, towards the end of last year. And it's essentially everything that we've been working on, everything that we're able to do with first party data at The Telegraph with our commercial partners, essentially. So it's an umbrella term for everything, all of our first party data initiatives for our commercial business. So that sits across targeting, whether that's targeting The Telegraph's first party audiences, advanced contextual targeting that's based on emotional tone of our journalism. We have a cookieless data matching solution called Telegraph Unity that's a really important part of our first party data strategy as well, that's based on the millions of logged in users that we have at The Telegraph. And finally, our first party insights too. So that's across, again, a whole wealth of different things, whether that's performance data, audience insights, search insights. We have our own reader panel as well, which is a base of 12,000 Telegraph readers who are able to survey directly to create really interesting qualitative insights too. So there's a whole breadth within each of those. It's an umbrella, but it's a fairly big umbrella. Sometimes it's a bit more like a parasol, I think, than an umbrella. But yeah, very broadly speaking, Telegraph One is our first party data initiative.
What stage is it? Is it at? When did it go into development? And what sort of stage are you at in terms of release?
Yeah, so Telegraph One actually came out last autumn, but it's a collection of things that we've been doing for quite some time. So we've had our partnerships with various different technology partners set up for some time. For example, we work with InfoSum for our data matching solution. That's been in place for a little while. So it's really the amalgamation of everything that we've been working on over a period of many months. But Telegraph One as a whole came out more formally towards the end of last year, and we've seen really successful uptake across all of those elements, really. I think particularly the insights that we were able to share with brands and with agencies last year across, you know, the reader panel, the sentiment tracker that we can create off the back of that. That was really valuable last year, because things were changing so fast and traditional insights perhaps couldn't keep up with the rate of change. But we were able to survey our reader panel every week and track their changing sentiments every single week on things like, how do you feel about booking a holiday right now? Are you holding off? Have you already booked something? And it's really interesting to see how that aligns with the changing announcements that came back as the news agenda rolled on. So we've seen huge value in our insights, but then also in our targeting and our data matching capabilities too. We've seen some fantastic results across Unity. We've been able to measure those using brand uplift studies. In some cases, we've seen results six times higher than industry benchmarks across those brand uplift studies where we've used our data matching capabilities. Really high engagement on our audience targeting as well. And probably the newest piece of that is our advanced contextual targeting solution, which is called Telegraph Texture. That's probably one of the newer elements to Telegraph One, but it's a really exciting one because it allows us to understand the emotional tone in which a piece of journalism or an article has been written, as well as the subject matter that it's about, and to unlock the value of that for different advertisers, for different types of campaigns across different verticals, and to see the nuances in engagement and how readers react to different pieces of journalism, but also to different types of advertising within that environment, I think is fascinating, both for insights and for targeting. So there's lots more to do there.
What kind of response? You mentioned that, you know, you've had quite a positive response, but especially as we get closer to cookie deprecation, even though it has been extended slightly, what sort of response do you anticipate it will get as the deadline draws nearer and, you know, advertisers turn away from third-party cookies as they have to and towards more contextual and first-party solutions?
Yeah, I think it will really depend on different businesses and different verticals. You know, if we take data matching, for example, I think that's a really powerful, fantastic solution for a lot of brands, but not every single brand is going to have sufficient first-party data of their own to match with a publisher based on, you know, logged in users or whatever that might be. So that might not work for every single brand in every context. But what we've aimed to do with Telegraph One, and where I think part of the value is that we've tried to create a roster of products that can be used across all different verticals and brands, so that there's kind of something for everyone. So regardless of what state of data maturity you're in, what level of sophistication you're looking for, your campaign goals, what type of business you have, we've really tried to cater to as many different eventualities as possible, as well as leveraging the strength of everything that we have, everything that we've been investing in terms of our subscriber strategy and our commercial data strategy as well. So we're trying to build something that will work as broadly as possible, in recognition of the fact that not every advertiser is going to be in exactly the same position. And I think that with the number of options that are being mooted in markets, we'll probably see very different responses from different advertisers. Certainly, I don't think there's going to be one way in which everybody swings. I think there'll probably be a variety of different methods used.
And thinking more broadly about sort of life beyond the cookie, what sort of you know, targeting methods or techniques do you think will come to the fore? There's lots of talk, obviously, about you know, first party data and contextual as well. Do you think that they will be probably the apex going forward, or are there other methods that you see sort of coming to the fore as well?
I think, I think first-party audience targeting, contextual targeting are both going to be really important going forward. I think, you know, as with anything, we'll have to sort of wait and see. It's interesting for me because really a lot of these solutions that we're talking about, in themselves, inherently, they've existed for a really long time. You know, first-party audience targeting is nothing new. We've been doing that at The Telegraph in various different guises for a number of years, but we're really just kind of developing all of these things further, you know, applying scientific reasoning to how we create our segmentation strategy. As I said, creating this new advanced contextual targeting solution that sits alongside our existing contextual targeting. You know, there's value in all of these things. So it's interesting to see how existing solutions are going to be advanced. And I think that's one of the positives, actually, of all the changes going on, is that it's refocusing attention on these really valuable sources of information, you know, first party data from a quality source, and seeing what more can we do with this. You know, we've been leveraging it for a while, but what next? How much better can we make this? I think that's one of the really positive things going on at the moment.
And do you think that, again, speaking a bit more broadly about post-cookie targeting, do you think that logins will become sort of integral to these solutions and in making the anonymous web addressable?
I think logged in user strategies are going to be, you know, really important. I think they are already. We've been on a journey with this for quite some time. We actually started accruing registered users way back in 2016, but we've really kind of upped the ante and focused much more on our subscriber strategy over the last couple of years. So we've seen an uptick from zero a couple of years ago all the way to hundreds of thousands now in a really short space of time. So that's the focus that we have and our focus as a business. And I think that for brands and for media owners as well, logged in users will be a crucial element of that. You know, I keep coming back to that direct relationship between between an individual, a consumer, a reader, and a publisher, or the brand, or the website that they're interacting with. I think it's really important. I think I don't anticipate that every single interaction that we as individuals have online will be in a logged in state. I don't think we'll get to that place. I think that wouldn't necessarily even be appropriate. But yeah, I think logged in strategies, as we have invested heavily in and we're really excited about, will continue to be important.
Everybody will be off Apple then and over to Androids.
We'll wait and see how the pendulum swings.
Great stuff. Well, thank you very much, Camilla, for, you know, elaborating on Telegraph One. And it's certainly something we'll have to keep an eye on here at ExchangeWire and keep in touch with you about. But we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Camilla, for guesting on the podcast. It was lovely having you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was lovely to be here.
Not at all. And thank you also, Anne-Marie.
Thank you. And thanks, Camilla. It's been a really enjoyable chat.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. And that was the Mad Tech Podcast.